Iran says the roadmap for Tuesday's meeting of the JCPOA Joint Commission in Vienna is the lifting of all U.S. sanctions against Tehran. A rights group says Israel has arrested 230 Palestinian children since the beginning of this year, and that those detention are subject to various forms of abuse. And Jordan's former crown prince, accused of plotting to destabilize the country, says he will defy the army's orders to limit his movement. Good to have you with us. Our top story, Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman says that a roadmap for the Tuesday meeting of the JCPOA Joint Commission in Vienna is the lifting of all U.S. sanctions against Tehran.
The roadmap is quite clear, removal all of sanctions of United States, which has been imposed by United States against Iran, extraterritorial sanctions and illegal sanctions that United States has imposed on Iran altogether should be removed.
Khatibzadeh says that Iran only accepts a one-step revival of the 2015 nuclear deal, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. He added the focus of the meeting will also be on return of other signatories to the JCPOA commitments. Khatibzadeh also dismissed any direct or indirect talks with Washington over the nuclear deal. Now, the comments come ahead of an upcoming meeting of JCPOA Joint Commission in Austrian capital. Representatives from Iran, China, Russia, France, Britain, Germany will meet in Vienna on Tuesday. A rights group says that Israel has arrested 230 Palestinian children since the beginning of 2021. A recently published report by the Palestinian Prison Society says that most of the arrests were made in occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds. The imprisoned children are kept behind bars under harsh conditions, including being denied food or drink for long hours. The detained children are also subject to various forms of abuse. The minors are often released either on bail or by transferring to house arrest. The report does not elaborate on the number of children who have been released. Official Palestinian data says that some 44,000 Palestinians, including hundreds of women and children, are held in Israeli detention facilities. Mona Kandil joined us earlier and explained about the situation of the Palestinian children detained by the Tel Aviv regime.
The Israelis come at the middle of the night, they arrest the children. This is against the law. Of course, their hands would be cuffed and their eyes would be covered. They would be left for days without food, and they are interrogated and even beaten by the Israeli soldiers. At the same time, lawyers and family members were not allowed to attend the interrogation. According to the international law, any forces are not allowed to interrogate or investigate children and minors without the attendance of their lawyer or a family member.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu appears in court for his corruption trial. He arrived at a court in Jerusalem Al-Quds following an order from the judges to attend the opening arguments in the case. In the court session, the prosecutors said that Netanyahu has made illegitimate use of power. The Israeli premier is charged with bribery, fraud, and breach of trust. A large crowd of protesters gathered outside the court. Netanyahu claims to be the victim of a witch hunt. He's expected to appear in court several times. Netanyahu would not be forced to resign as prime minister unless he's convicted, with all appeals exhausted. Jordan's former crown prince, Hamza bin Hussein, says that he will disobey the army's order not to communicate with the outside world after he was put under house arrest. Hamza made the claim in a voice recording released on Monday. On Saturday, the military warned the prince over actions it said were undermining security and stability in Jordan. Also, the country's deputy prime minister accuses Hamza of colluding with foreign parties to destabilize the country. Some 20 high-ranking officials were arrested in connection with the case. Prince Hamza has denied being part of any foreign conspiracy. He says he was put under house arrest as part of crackdown on dissent. A new report suggests that there was a 33% rise in homicides in major American cities last year amid then-prevailing anger at racial injustice and police brutality. The report produced by the Major Cities Chiefs Association includes homicide, rape, robbery, and aggravated assault. It says 63 of the 66 largest police jurisdictions saw increases in at least one category of violent crimes. The increase in homicide rates is both historic and far-reaching. The report also suggests that a crime surge has continued into the first quarter of the year. In Chicago and New York City, homicides and shootings are up between 30 and 50% in the first 3 months of the year compared to 2020. Experts argue factors such as economic collapse, social anxiety, and calls for depolicing could have contributed to the spike in homicides. The first week in the trial of a former white American police officer, Derek Chauvin, has ended. He's charged with killing unarmed African American George Floyd in Minneapolis last year. Different witnesses, from senior officers to paramedics and family members, have shared their testimonies in a series of emotional sessions.
Of Derek Chauvin, a former American cop who knelt on the neck of an unarmed black man for about 9 minutes in Minneapolis last May. Chauvin is charged with the death of that arrested man, George Floyd. The first week of the trial was marked by dramatic and emotional accounts. An eyewitness broke down in tears while responding to prosecutors.
I heard him keep trying to ask them to let him up so he can't breathe, and even I said to the officer, I said, man, he said he can't breathe. And they said, well, if he keep talking, he can breathe.
Floyd's partner of nearly 3 years also got very emotional while testifying. One of the key moments of the trial was on the fifth day of the proceedings. That's when a senior homicide investigator called Chauvin's use of force on Floyd totally unnecessary.
First of all, pulling him down to the ground, face down, and putting your knee on the neck for that amount of time is just uncalled for.
What level of force might that be?
That would be the top tier, the deadly force.
Why?
Because of the fact that if your knee is on a person's neck, that can kill them.
Many Americans also say Floyd's death has had profound emotional and psychological consequences for them.
It's very traumatic for a black person to follow a trial of a black person who was innocently murdered.
I think it's opened a lot of people's minds to be on the lookout for discrimination.
And so I think that a lot of people, or maybe of my color, have been suffering from that sort of PTSD and trauma.
We also have to have that conversation of what is the role of the police.
One can say that what unites all these people is the trauma of watching the death of a black man under the knee of a white police officer. Chauvin has pleaded not guilty to the charges against him. His lawyers argue that Floyd died due to drug overdose. That's while medical examiners have said his death was homicide at the hands of police. The case of George Floyd is undoubtedly a clear example of police injustice and brutality in the United States. His death has already become a symbol of a rallying cry for a global movement against systemic racism and discrimination. But how many other victims are needed for U.S. police to stop abusing their power, especially against minorities in a country known for its racial diversity?
In other news, the Iranian Health Ministry has designated the capital city of Tehran as a high-risk area as the number of COVID cases keeps rising in the country. Along with Tehran, several other major cities are also announced as red zones. The category requires the organizations and workplaces to reduce the number of employees to one-third. It also bans residents from leaving the city while prohibiting entering of the non-locals. Currently, 88 cities are designated as a red. Daily COVID cases and deaths have been increasing in Iran the past few days, fatalities reaching three-digit figures. And the spike comes after the Persian New Year holidays. Iran has recorded 2 million coronavirus cases and 63,000 deaths. Now, India has registered more than 100,000 new coronavirus cases in one day. That's a record rise since the outbreak of disease in that country. India's total caseload is now nearing 13 million, the highest after the U.S. and Brazil. The health ministry says 478 people succumbed to the disease in the past day, raising the tally to more than 165,000. India's daily infections have jumped about 12-fold since hitting a multiple low this February when the authorities eased most restrictions. Nearly half of the new infections are reported in India's richest state of Maharashtra. The state has announced shutting shopping malls, movie theaters, restaurants, and places of worship from Monday evening. The authorities will also impose a full lockdown over the weekend amid a shortage of hospital beds. Our New Delhi correspondent Munawar Zaman saying that the resurgence of coronavirus cases in India is due to the government's ill-conceived plan.
It is a humongous task to vaccinate those people. So giving a leniency in lockdowns or giving more lockdowns leniency was not an appropriate step to be taken. But now what I see, I've been covering some stories on COVID, the coronavirus across India. Well, I see people are not taking the issue very seriously. Most of the people, most of Indians believe now, since the vaccination is there, they don't need to worry about anything. But I've spoken with many medical experts. They believe there are new variants of coronavirus pandemic, and now people have to worry more about it. And possibly the one wave which we are seeing, which we're witnessing right now, is perhaps the second wave of COVID-19. And many health experts believe in the All India Institute of Medical Sciences and other health organizations. They believe this is going to be deadly and it is going to be disastrous for a country like India unless and until people don't adhere by the government guidelines. Now, certain steps have been taken in the state of Maharashtra, which is hit the hardest with more than 12,000-13,000 cases every day.
The United Nations Secretary General has expressed concerns about what it calls COVID-19 vaccine nationalism and hoarding by wealthier nations. And this while the countries across the world are witnessing a spike in COVID infections. We've discussed Tabak with our guests in our news review program. United Nations Secretary General has expressed concerns about what he's calling COVID-19 vaccine nationalism and hoarding by the world's wealthier nations. In a tweet, Antonio Guterres noted that vaccines must be made available and accessible to everyone as soon as possible. So far, nearly 650 million doses of the COVID-19 vaccine have been administered to people around the world. The richer nations, however, account for the majority of the figure. More than 131 million people have contracted the respiratory disease globally, some 2.8 million of whom have lost their lives. The UN has pledged to push for affordable vaccines for everyone to rapidly accelerate recovery and strengthen the global economy. Well, that was the story we're going to discuss and get some insight from our guests. I'll be joined by Seijiro Takeshita, Professor of Management with the University of Shizuoka. And also, we'll have Brian Berletic, an independent geopolitical analyst, who's joining us out of Bangkok. Welcome to the show, gentlemen. Let's go to Shizuoka first. Seijiro, we have this vaccine nationalism and hoarding issue that the UN Secretary General is complaining about. What's the reason behind this? And are these the wealthier nations who are actually using and they prefer their own people to others? Are they not the same people who are always crying wolf regarding human rights violations and that kind of thing? So when it comes to reaching out to others, they forget about others?
Well, it's very similar to the trade issue. The fact of the matter is that when things get pretty bad, people tend to run for protectionism, which really is actually adversary to the world economic growth, including the country that is trying to basically protect itself. So it's a very big irony, but that's a typical human nature, especially when political domestic issues are involved. And you're seeing exactly the same thing in this coronavirus. The more the vaccine spreads to other nations, the earlier the resolution will be for all of us. We all know that. But, you know, there's a lot of, as you just pointed out, a lot of political issues that will be involved, not only the domestic political issues, but as you can see from the act of China, what they're trying to do is utilize this as a card to expand their power cars and their hegemony in the area. So obviously, what we should be doing is, well, basically diffuse a lot more of action like COVAX, which is a mutual movement to purchase and distribute this drug. But, you know, that's not happening because of both the domestic political issues and also the hegemony of the region that is being fought over by several nations.
Mm-hmm. Now we're to Bangkok. Brian, would the UN be able to do this? Because they're talking about trying to make it affordable for everyone to get vaccinated. Is the UN able to do that, given the circumstances?
I think what the UN is trying to say here is it's very conservative, but I think the UN needs to understand their own limitations here. The West, with its unipolar order, they like to try to say things about human rights, equality, but we can see how they've used the COVID-19 crisis as an opportunity to advance their own positions. And the UN needs to recognize that these wealthy countries that would have to play a key role in making accessible medicine for any reason, not just COVID-19, these countries would have to be involved in that, and we can see that they're not acting in good faith. I think it goes beyond nationalism. I think they saw an opportunity here, a global crisis, to take advantage of it to advance their own positions. Now, China or Cuba or even Iran, these are countries that are developing their own vaccines. They're working together. They're working with other countries. I think if the UN wanted to do something towards this, they would help facilitate that process. Countries that have a proven track record of reaching out with their medical expertise and helping other nations, I think that would be the direction to go.
Okay. And Sayjira, what's your prediction? When will planet Earth get rid of this killer virus?
Well, unfortunately, I think the very dire conditions that we've just discussing me about is not going to be rectified right away, because as a gentleman pointed out, there will be countries that will be utilizing this as a tool to expand their, you know, political will. But also, if you look from a domestic side, for example, the wealth disparity in the United States is the highest among OECD nations, but it's getting bigger because of this, you know, COVID-19 crisis. Mm-hmm. People who are able to have the vaccines and who are not, if you look at the racial differences, you look at the wealth differences, it becomes very, very clear. And so, you know, from the domestic point of view as well, it's becoming very difficult to maneuver this situation. And it's not only the United States, but it's a lot of other European nations, including places like France. So, mm-hmm. you know, the Mexico dispute, obviously the pressure that the politicians are feeling is going to be far greater from here onwards. Mm-hmm. Because, again, the disparity is going to actually accelerate from here onwards. So mm-hmm. it's not only the international aspect, but it's also a domestic aspect that we will be seeing, which will disable, you know, people to sit on the table and negotiate and, you know, proceed or progress things like on COVAX. I think it will be a very unfortunate but dire and slow process that we'll be seeing from here onwards.
Okay. I appreciate your comments and insight. We had Seijiro Takeshita, Professor of Management with the University of Shizuoka, joined us out of Shizuoka, Japan. And Brian Berletic, independent geopolitical analyst, joined us from Bangkok. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on March 21st, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Nowruz. Domestic markets and natural resources.
One is the domestic market capacity. In other words, Iranian producers have an 80 million market at their disposal. This means that every producer is also a consumer. Overall, an 80 million market in a big country is available to Iranian producers, and this is an important opportunity in itself. Another important capacity is natural resources, some of which, but not all, we are using today, but we use them in the raw form. These resources include oil and gas. They are being consumed in the raw form, while they could be used in much better ways in order to create value added. Other examples include agricultural lands, pastures, and forests, which are great sources of wealth available to the Iranian nation. We have a good rank in the world in terms of underground minerals such as oil and gas, zinc, copper, iron ore, and the like. Our rank ranges from the first and second to ninth. We have such a great natural resources. Well, this is a very important capacity.
Your light and love, all I see. Nothing more I'd ever want to need, my Lord. Protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
Besides, important infrastructure has been built in the last 30 years, which did not exist before. Dams, power plants, rail and road transportation, and many other infrastructure. Well, if a country with such characteristics and with all these capacities formulates good economic plans, and if it benefits from efficient management, which is strong and capable of resolving the people's issues, which cares about the people and which is anti-corruption, later on, I will expand on the characteristics of such a manager in my discussion about elections, then that country will turn into an economically advanced country resistant against all sanctions. This does not mean that the sanctions will be lifted. Rather, it means that it does not matter if they are lifted or not. When there is a thriving and progressive economy, others will need that economy, and in such circumstances, sanctions will not make any sense.
The necessity for the people to show their cooperation.
Another point which is good to be discussed on the economic matters of the country is that eliminating the problems requires the people's cooperation. If the people enter any area, that area will surely improve. This has been the case until now. Whenever the people entered any area, that area improved.
the news line.
Shortly after taking office as South Vietnam's president in 1955, pro-American Ngo Dinh Diem began a crackdown on suspected members of the Viet Minh Communist Coalition of the North. The Cold War was in full swing, and the United States, which was concerned about a rise in communism, gradually ramped up its military presence in Vietnam. Washington finally found the excuse to justify a war in the region following an incident in the Gulf of Tonkin in 1963 when two U.S. destroyers were targeted by a torpedo attack by the North Vietnamese forces. The U.S. Congress then approved the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, which authorized U.S. military action in the region. The conflict that ensued has been regarded as one of the bloodiest wars the U.S. has ever been involved in. American troops resorted to using warfares, including napalm and chemical toxins, to confront their enemy. Perhaps the most notorious was a chemical substance called Agent Orange that was used during Operation Ranch Hand to defoliate jungles to uncover Vietnamese troops and destroy crops between 1961 and 1971. The substance contained dioxin, which is one of the most toxic chemicals known to man and has been linked to severe birth defects, cancers, and mental and physical disabilities.
You have to understand that America has a different standard for the rest of the world than it does at home. At home, America adheres to fairly high level standards when it comes to herbicides, for example, of which Agent Orange is one. But when it comes to the poor nations of the world, such as Laos or Cambodia, a completely different standard applies.
The U.S. failure in the war and its atrocities in terms of the number of civilian deaths and the use of chemical weapons has tarnished America's image at home and abroad to date. The U.S. rained down some 600,000 gallons of herbicides on the neutral nation of Laos and roughly 19 million gallons of such chemicals in Vietnam. The chemicals were so potent that even American troops got a taste of their detrimental effects. After 14 years of legal dispute, the U.S. Congress passed the Orange Agent Act in 1991 to compensate American veterans of the Vietnam War who were exposed to the toxin. But it wasn't until the year 2000 that Washington started to admit responsibility for what the people of Vietnam and Laos have been going through. Washington kicked off a 10-year project to decontaminate swathes of Vietnamese land from the herbicide in 2019, but stopped short of awarding compensation to the families of the victims. There's also no mention of U.S. chemical attacks on neutral Laos during the war. Even after the American military acknowledged the attacks, a former American commander denied all knowledge about the use of dioxin there.
Laos was a country that was caught in the middle of the Indo-Chinese War. The U.S. Was absolutely indiscriminate in its use of Agent Orange and other weapons of war against the population. It never apologized. It never had any second thoughts. As far as the U.S. was concerned, it was just a collateral damage. So the U.S. has never made good on that. It's never made good on the enormous damage that was done to Cambodia, or certainly the incredible bloodshed that was imposed on Vietnam.
The Vietnam War ended long ago, but not for thousands of people living in Vietnam and Laos who are still being haunted by its effects.
The annual United States Report on Global Human Rights Practices looked at human rights issues in Israel, the West Bank, and Gaza as part of its global analysis on almost 200 nations. In the first such report of the Biden administration, the U.S. reaffirmed the recognition of Israel's sovereignty over the Golan Heights and the recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital. That is while Washington has refused to slam the Israeli regime for its illegal occupation of the Palestinian territories as well as other crimes. More than 600,000 Israelis live in over 230 illegal settlements built since the 1967 Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories, of the West Bank and East Jerusalem outlets. That is while the UN Security Council has repeatedly condemned Israel's settlement activities in the occupied territories in several resolutions. Also, according to human rights groups, acts of violence by Israeli settlers against Palestinians and their property are a daily occurrence throughout the occupied West Bank. Additionally, Israel holds more than 7,000 Palestinians in its jails. Most of the prisoners are being held with no indictments or trial under a controversial policy known as administrative detention.
Well, in the first place, the U.S. lacks the moral authority to talk about human rights in any country outside of its own boundaries. Inside the U.S., there is systemic racism against people of color and against people of indigenous origin. And this has been going on for 400 years inside the what is now the United States. Their record has been terrible. And to just a couple of days ago, the trial of the police man who killed George Floyd is taking place. So the U.S. has no moral authority whatsoever.
The Israeli regime's crimes seem to have no end, and the international community only condemns the regime's atrocities in words. This is while Israel is violating international law. The Golan Heights were part of Syria until 1967, when the Israeli regime captured most of the area during the Six-Day War. In 1973, Egypt and Syria launched a war against the Israeli regime in an effort to recapture the occupied territories. However, with Washington's help, Israel managed to retain control over the territory it occupied before. Then in 1981, Israel declared its unilaterally annexing East Jerusalem and the Golan Heights in order to extend its own boundaries to cover the captured territories. In response, the UN Security Council passed Resolution 497 and condemned the annexation of Syrian territory. The council declared the annexation a violation of international law. Meanwhile, Syria has repeatedly reaffirmed its sovereignty over the Golan Heights, saying the territory must be completely restored to its control. The Golan Heights territory is strategically important due to its military value. It is also a strategic asset due to its water resources and fertile land. In a relatively parched region of the world, control over the Golan's water supplies is invaluable. The Golan Heights may also have oil. Exploratory drilling suggests that the territory's reservoirs could potentially yield billions of barrels of oil. The annual United States report on global human rights practices also reaffirmed Israeli sovereignty over the Golan Heights, which the U.S. recognized in 2019. In March 2019, the former U.S. President Donald Trump signed a decree recognizing Israeli sovereignty over Golan during a meeting with the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Washington. The Syrian government denounced Washington's recognition of Israeli claims over the Golan Heights as a blatant attack on the country's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Over the past decades, Israel has built dozens of settlements in the Golan Heights in defiance of international calls for the regime to stop its illegal construction activities.
Indeed, they are illegal, and nothing that the U.S. says or does can turn a crime into a legal act. Except for the USA, the entire world recognizes that the Golan Heights are part of the sovereign territory of Syria, and someday Syria will regain control of the Golan Heights.
The trial of former U.S. police officer Derek Chauvin began earlier this week. Chauvin is accused of killing 46-year-old African-American George Floyd by kneeling on his neck for more than 9 minutes during an arrest last May. Floyd's death triggered worldwide protests over brutal policing tactics and racial injustice. Prosecutors have said the former Minneapolis officer killed Floyd without regard for his life. They insist Chauvin betrayed his badge by kneeling on Floyd's neck and using excessive and unreasonable force as the black man kept begging for his life.
So you'd want to get him up out of
the high-profile trial is expected to take 1 month.
During the next few weeks, prosecutors will ask medical and use of force experts, among others, to testify. If convicted of murder and manslaughter charges, the former police officer could be jailed for decades. Chauvin has denied the charges. His defense lawyers argue that the force used during the arrest was reasonable and that Floyd died of an overdose and poor health. U.S. police officers who cause a death while they're on duty are rarely charged, and only about a third of those charged are convicted. This ongoing trial is followed across the U.S. and around the world as a strong indication of how the American legal system treats deaths in police custody. The ongoing trial has captured media attention in the U.S. and around the world. Everyone wants to know how the proceedings will end. But there is still a strong possibility that justice will not be served in Floyd's case, just as it wasn't served in many other high-profile police killings of unarmed African Americans over the past years. The 2014 police killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson was another example in which the white officer who shot the black man was not indicted. Black Americans are disproportionately more likely to be fatally shot by police and arrested for drug abuse, and five times more likely than white Americans to be imprisoned. Experts believe ethnic minorities in America, especially African Americans, are facing a very deep-rooted problem that will not be resolved anytime soon.
Black people in the United States are incarcerated, jailed, locked up, arrested more than any other race at more than any other rate in this country, disproportionate to their percentage of the population. Even though black people in the United States represent just over 13% of the population, they're targeted and they're victimized more to the prison industrial complex more than any other group in the United States. And that's something that we really have to begin to tackle in the United States to understand the roots of the prison industrial complex, of the police as catchers of enslaved people.
Observers largely attribute this trend to the racist roots of American policing and social structures. Law enforcement in many U.S. states, especially those in the south of the United States, have their roots in slave patrols that were formed centuries ago. Such patrols located and forcefully returned enslaved people who had escaped.
The first reason for police to begin with to exist in the United States were to catch enslaved people who liberated themselves from their owners who fled to the north. And that's why you'll see the first badges of the police from the 1800s said the words slave patrol, because that was one of their first jobs, to catch liberated enslaved peoples who were running to the north for freedom, for economic opportunity. That's the roots of policing in the United States, and we have to contend with that in order to deal with this.
The federal government banned the use of racist regulations at the state and local level many decades ago. Yet, ethnic minorities are subject to discrimination and profiling. Former U.S. President Donald Trump gained notoriety for fueling racial tensions and discrimination through provocative comments and stances. His successor, Joe Biden, has been an outspoken critic of racial injustice. But it remains to be seen whether he can truly lead the U.S. towards a less racially discriminative future.
Iran and China have signed a cooperation pact dubbed the Sino-Iranian Comprehensive Strategic Partnership. The deal was signed by the foreign ministers of the two countries in Tehran. The agreement includes political, strategic, and economic cooperation over the next 25 years. The pact would see Iran supply China with oil for 25 years. In return, China would invest in Iran's ports as well as its banking and telecom sectors. The pact has been in works since 2016, when President Xi Jinping became the first Chinese leader to visit the Iranian capital in over a decade. Many believe that the Iran-China agreement is aimed at standing up against U.S. pressure on the two countries.
Apart from this bilateral perspective, I think this signed agreement could be considered as a response, in a sense, in order to broaden the scope of the options that Iran has in its foreign policy, knowing the fact that Iran has been practicing negotiations with the Western side, and then after all these years, and after JCPOA was signed and sealed, and later on was kind of not effective for Iranian signatory of the deal, now there is this consensus among Iranian politicians that they should broaden the scope of their international relations, and obviously China is going to be one of the most powerful options to be taken into consideration.
The agreement drew an outright reaction from Washington.
How concerning is the emerging partnership between China and Iran?
I've been concerned about that for a year.
Biden made the remarks in an address to reporters in the U.S. city of Wilmington. In response, Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, said the signing of the Iran and China Strategic Partnership Roadmap is part of the active resistance policy. Shamkhani said the world isn't just the West, noting, however, that Biden's concern is justified as a flourishing of strategic cooperation in the East will accelerate the U.S. decline.
Well, I think the agreement that we are currently discussing could kind of pave the way for the U.S. hegemony to be broken, at least in Asia. And this is quite against the strategies that the United States is following in order to, let's say, increase its hegemonic power, specifically in Asia and particularly in the Middle East. So this particular framework could kind of, let's say, put the United States in a rather isolated situation. And could, of course, put China and Iran in a better situation.
Iran's closer cooperation with China, on one hand, can help Tehran shore up its economy against the impacts of the U.S. sanctions. On the other hand, the Tehran-Beijing alliance may be seen as a challenge to President Biden's China policy. This as the two major economic powers have been at odds over a string of issues, including trade, with each side having imposed tariffs worth of hundreds of billions of dollars on other side's goods. This stalemate has prompted China to increase its imports of Iranian oil to around 1 million barrels a day, eroding U.S. leverage. Many believe that China's new partnership with Iran is not a full alliance, but enough to undermine U.S. sanctions and rock the global status quo.
Whether we call it a strategic partnership or alliance or whatever you name it, the thing is that the very tangible consequence of this, let's say, new deal is that the world has to come to this realization that the calculations are, let's say, rapidly changing. And in this recent situation, the United States and its Western partners are not going to be able to consider themselves as the only powers and as the only superpowers of the world with respect to the new emerging powers and with respect to great economic powers that are emerging in Asia. And this is going to definitely change the context, not only in the Middle East and not only in Asia, but also all over the world. And new line of calculations are going to be met for the years down the road.
This as Washington has expressed eagerness to enter stalled talks with Tehran to revive the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. Former U.S. President Donald Trump pulled out Washington from the agreement, claiming Tehran violated it. This as the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, has on multiple occasions reiterated Tehran's full compliance with the international accord. The Trump administration went even further by imposing a signature maximum pressure campaign against the Islamic Republic. All in all, it seems that Iran and China can establish an economic bloc if Tehran-Beijing Comprehensive Partnership Agreement expands to other countries in Asia and through that confront the U.S. unilateralism.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
Aysel Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatih al-Jiran, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house, many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up, we must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zaid Al-Salami. A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah al-Uzma al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. We're still talking about how you deal with yourself, how you are able to find life skills for the purpose of you becoming a better person individually, yourself. And therefore, in this book, Mafatih al-Hayat, on chapter number 10, Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli starts to discuss an important topic which we regularly do, and that is traveling. And there are many places in the Holy Quran and also in the Sunnah of Ahlul Bayt that speak about how beneficial traveling is, referring to it as sayr, referring to it as safar, you know, siru, qul siru fil ard, journey around the lands and the earth and see how it is. Another verse in the Holy Quran says, is God's earth, is God's land not vast enough for you to be able to migrate to different places and see how different things are and different places are, different civilizations? Without doubt, there is always going to be a lot of benefit in a person traveling. And that's why it's a sunnah for one to find times in order for them to travel and have journeys. We know that even when it came to our own imams, they would travel frequently, whether it be towards Makkah al-Mukarramah for Hajj or Umrah, or whether it be to other regions and other cities as well. And we can see that it is also the seerah of our ulama as well, where they always tried to travel around and making sure that the main purpose for their traveling was for them to seek knowledge, to seek experience, to see how others are, to share knowledge and experience as well. And that's why this beautiful piece of poetry attributed to Imam Ali alayhi salam is always mentioned in this regard, where he says, وَسَافِرْ فَفِي الْأَسْفَارِ خَمْسُ فَوَائِدِ. Travel, because in traveling there are five benefits. فَسَافِرْ فَفِي الْأَسْفَارِ خَمْسُ فَوَائِدَ. تَفَرُّجُ هَمِّنْ. Number one is that you relieve yourself from grief and sorrow. That it's a time of relaxation. وَاكْتِسَابُ مَعِيشَةٍ. That it could be a source of income, a source of sustenance. اِكْتِسَابُ مَعِيشَةٍ. وَعِلْمٌ. It could be a way for you to gain knowledge. وَآدَابٌ. Number four is, it could be a way for you to experience mannerism, for you to learn etiquette, for you to learn adab. And the last is, وَصُحْبَةُ مَاجِدِ, and for you to be able to accompany a righteous person, for you to be with someone who is noble. وَصُحْبَةُ مَاجِدِ. Majid, majid means nobility, it means righteousness.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatih al Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree.
امام همونطوری که این رو گفته دارم گفته دی اون امامی که گفته اگر روزه بگیری ثواب داره همون امام گفته که اگر درخت بکاری اون ثواب داره.
Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam who has stressed out the reward for praying has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree.
محیط زیست نگه سالم نگه داره این دقل ثواب داره.
There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment.
وقتی میخوای کشاورزی کنی یه قدر گندم بگیر رو به قبله بیست این دعا رو بخون اینم هم امام گفته دیگه.
When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned.
تو نظام اسلامی این جلد دوم جاش خالی.
We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
And so these kind of things that bring about that importance of why we should travel. Of course, we know that there are adab of safar. Most important is that you choose the day of your traveling. Remember that there's this whole issue of calculating al-qamar fil aqrab, when the when Scorpio is aligned with the moon, and the important dates that they have, which is very, very makruh for a person to travel when al-qamar fil aqrab. And alhamdulillah, the good thing is on the internet you're able to make the calculations and find in these certain sites like rafid.net, and you'll be able to just put in your the date that you have and it'll tell you whether al-qamar fil aqrab or not. Also remembering that there might be certain days which is better for you to travel in, like for example Saturday. To start off your traveling, always start off your traveling with making sure that it is a trip that you are going to benefit from. It is a trip that is free of sin. Always remember that if you were to travel wherever it may be, whatever it may be, and that traveling will entail sin in it, it will be a wretched trip. It will be a trip that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will give you, of course, a lot of damnation for, in the sense that you won't even be able to pray qasr prayer. You have to pray tamam prayer. And of course, that kind of negative sin what's the point, what's the benefit in it? Which is exactly why there are so many ad'iyya that it is recommended for you to recite when you are going to embark on a trip. Remember that you also need to make sure that your parents are happy with your safar, and or else it'll turn into safar ma'asiyah. That your husband is also happy with your trip, and you leaving the house. Walhamdulillahi rabbil alameen. Wassalatu wassalamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahirin.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams. Hear the children scream.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time. Memories fade like a dusty windowpane, and you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart that will always be there. Be there.
Economic divide.
Hello and welcome to Economic Divide with me, Kaveh Tahwai. In this week's episode, we will look at the ailing EU economy, in which the country's 27 member bloc are suffering some of the worst recessions ever due to the COVID-19 pandemic and its subsequent lockdowns. The actual recession warning was issued roughly back in May of 2020. Now it's almost a year later. How are the EU countries doing? Well, let's take a look at Italy, France, and Spain. In this case, the services sector. As you can see, it's being pummeled. These are some of the countries holding the highest debts in the EU. The Eurozone economy was already expected to contract during the first 3 months of 2021 for it to actually enter a double-dip recession. You may ask what a double-dip recession is. Here's an example of it. This particular one, you could see just the shape of the line. Now, double-dip recession is actually what happened in the U.S. between the years 1978 and 83. The economy recovered from a recession that peaked in the summer of 1980 to return to positive growth by the end of the year, as is seen towards the end there. But by Christmas of 1981, another deep recession had made its way. Now, if the outlook for the EU remains grim, which it does, then what is the EU going to do about it to make sure that member countries are going to weather economic downturns? This is while many EU countries are still in the midst of the pandemic and are experiencing a recession, countries like France, Germany, Italy, and Greece.